saying it. He didn't even understand the problem. He was transposing the words without even being aware of it. "Tommy," Sandy finally said, "where is this coming from? How many times can you confuse that line? What kind of house do you have, anyway?" Tommy was blinking, dazed, sullen, running his hand through his hair. He tried it again and made the same mistake. Soon enough, two extras quit. They had better things to do than watch a writer, star, director, producer, executive producer going at his own script with a cleaver. A couple of crew members were press-ganged into being extras for the remainder of the night. Byron wasn't happy with Tommy's and my fight. It's supposed to be a ferocious struggle between two men over a devilish woman. But we were shooting two guys holding each other's arms and hissing. Grade school fights are typically more brutal. That didn't mean that Tommy wasn't hurting me during our takes. He happens to have the most insanely powerful hands of any human being I've ever known, pure cyborg strength. And by the end of the night, I had bruises all over my wrists and forearms. After a bunch of takes, Byron had seen enough. "Look," he said, "you guys are fighting like a couple of pansies." Of the many words you should never use to refer to Tommy Wiseau, pansy is high in the upper quartile. On the next take, Tommy caught me off guard and finally went for it. He gave me a hard and unpansy-like shove. I fell backward, landed on my can, and for good measure hit the back of my head against the door, which is the take that wound up in the film. Tempers were short by this point. When it came time for the Steven character to jump in and break up Johnny and Mark's fight, Greg Ellery grabbed Tommy, which made Tommy lose track of his lines. When Johnny turns to Steven and yells, "Shut up! Shut up!" that's Tommy really yelling at poor Greg. Well past everyone's bedtime, we finally finished this emotionally exhausting sequence. Next up was the scene in which I had to say to Steven, "Leave your stupid comments in your pocket." The line wasn't remotely sayable. I couldn't imagine even Liam Neeson saying this line convincingly. Tommy gave me a brief reprieve from attempting to deliver the line, however, when he decided that he wanted another scene of me and Juliet kissing. In the original script, Mark tells Peter to keep his stupid comments in his pocket, but this confrontation does not piggyback on Peter's catching Mark and Lisa secretly canoodling on the couch at Johnny's birthday party. Peter doesn't need to catch Mark and Lisa because he already knows they're romantically involved. But now that the character of Steven had entered the picture, the film needed a moment of discovery, and that moment of discovery had to turn on Mark and Lisa groping each other on the couch. In a way, I was impressed. For once, Tommy had accurately identified and worked to solve a plot hole in his own script. The first couple of times I tried to say, "Leave your stupid comments in your pocket," the words just didn't come. I felt paralyzed, as though I were apologizing to some future audience. The line seemed a violation of drama, of cinema, of language itself. Every time I looked at Juliet, she could see how hard I was concentrating. This always made her laugh, at which point we had to start all over again. After one calamitous take, I asked Tommy if we could go with another line. Byron backed me up on this. Wouldn't "shut the fuck up" work a lot better? But whenever Tommy was questioned about his script, he doubled down. He wasn't going to let any of us move on until he had this ridiculous line of dialogue in the can. "The problem," Tommy told me, "is that you're not upset. No emotion. You need to be upset." "No," I said. "The problem is the line doesn't work." "The line," Tommy said, "worked just fine." Byron and I exchanged a long, complicated look of shared misery. Then Byron shrugged. "Guess you gotta give the man what he wants." I tried it again. "It's not enough," Tommy said. "Not enough. Not at all enough." As we set up again, this was what I told myself. If you can land this pointless, nonsensical line, you will be one step closer to the end and forgetting about this whole experience. What are you even worried about? No one's going to see this thing. It's going to sit on a shelf in Tommy's house. It's not going to kill you, they're just words. Leave your stupid comments in your pocket, see? Easy. Come on, Greg, Tommy said when I tried again. You're not upset. Actually, I said, I am upset. Then give me something, damn it! So I imagined I was saying the line to Tommy, and then changed all the words in my head. Leave your stupid comments in your pocket, while I was thinking, why are you doing this to me? On the next take, no surprise, I nailed it. Well, maybe not nailed it, but the words came out with real spitting cobra force. In some sense, saying the line felt like an exorcism of every terrible room experience I'd had up until that point. I'm not saying it again, I said, walking away from the camera. I'm done. A decade later, the phrase I had such trouble wrapping my mind around, much less saying aloud, has at least 3 UrbanDictionary.com entries. The afternoon after we shot the leave your stupid comments in your pocket scene, Tommy and I arrived on set to find Sandy sitting on an apple crate in the Burns and Sawyer parking lot. He looked relieved. I knew immediately what he was going to say. Tommy, he said, standing up. I'm sorry, but I'm gonna have to leave your project. I got another offer, and it's too good to pass up. Tommy said nothing. He didn't ask Sandy what this other offer was. It's with Janusz Kaminski, Sandy said, and waited. Kaminski had been Steven Spielberg's DP for his last 7 films, and was commonly regarded as one of the greatest living cinematographers. Tommy, I could all but guarantee, had never heard of Kaminski. I doubt he knows who he is even now. If we lost Sandy, I felt the room might not be completed. He'd been extremely helpful, and we still had a lot of complicated, important scenes to film. Well, complicated by room standards. Byron had been useful, but Sandy actually got into the trenches with Tommy. The only reason we'd gotten anything even remotely watchable on film was due to his ability to turn Tommy's vision into something slightly less extraterrestrial. I knew Sandy was relieved to be leaving now, because looming next in line to film were Tommy's love scenes. That, really, was Sandy's choice. Tommy's naked ass, or Steven Spielberg's director of photography. Tommy kept staring at Sandy. I'm sorry, man, Sandy said, his hands out. It's Kaminski, the guy's got 2 Oscars. Tommy said nothing. I've got to take it, Sandy said, clearly boggled by Tommy's silence. It's Spielberg! Kaminski shot Schindler's List! Sandy was right, of course. He had to take it. It would be insane for anyone to tell him not to take it. I'm sure half of the crew wanted to jump in the back of Sandy's pickup and ride off the Burns and Sawyer lot with him. Tommy finally spoke. So what? I don't want to hear this stuff. Oscar nothing. If you leave, don't come back. Tommy then did to Sandy what he had done to so many people in so many circumstances. He turned away, made Sandy the enemy, and instantly sought to replace him. 14. Highway of Hell. If I could just go back, if I could rub everything out, starting with myself. Tom Ripley, the talented Mr. Ripley. Tommy had begun to write. Sometimes he spent the whole day on his computer, behind his black velvet curtains, using 2 fingers to peck out his play, script. Whatever he was writing, his description of it changed day to day. Occasionally, he'd call out things like, "Prepare yourself physically and mentally!" Or, "How many pages does normal movie script have?" Or, tell me not to eat any more of those chocolate muffins. Or, this place is too small, I can't think in this house. At the end of the day, I'd find him sitting at the small kitchen table, looking happy and tired as he quietly devoured a chocolate muffin. Aren't all these human needs strange? He asked one night. Human behavior is funny stuff. But he wasn't talking to me. He was talking to his script. As the weeks went on, the stress of writing wore Tommy down. Sometimes he woke up in the middle of the night screaming about leg cramps. Other times, when he noticed my irritation with him, he'd say, "Don't try to poison my oatmeal, okay?" I was still looking for somewhere else to live, but not very diligently, largely because my non-sleeping hours were rarely spent in the apartment anyway. I'd booked a gig on Days of Our Lives thanks to my ability to do a French accent. The role was a guy named Jules, who claimed to be from France. This was his way of picking up gullible American women, but was actually from Indianapolis. I appeared a couple of times over several months, until Jules was forced to admit he wasn't French at all, after which he was shot to death at a party. C'est la vie, as Jules would say. I was still taking Jeff Corey's acting class. Aside from my being berated by Bob Dylan for blocking his driveway, it remained an enjoyable experience. Sometimes my scene partners would call me at home to discuss rehearsals. Tommy hated it when the phone rang before noon, but if they called after that, Tommy could be surprisingly chatty. "Your cousin is so sweet," Rena, one of my scene partners, said to me. It turned out that she'd called one afternoon when I wasn't there and wound up talking to Tommy for 20 minutes. "He's a bit out there, though, isn't he? He asked me a lot of really intense questions about acting." Tommy's version of this: "I talked to your friend, Arena. We have great conversation. Don't be jealous." For the most part, though, Tommy was so focused on his script that he hardly seemed to notice anything. As he withdrew deeper behind his velvet curtains, my need to move out seemed less pressing. As long as Tommy stayed focused on his writing project, I figured we would manage being roommates for a little longer. Then Tommy raised the rent again. He claimed that it was being raised on him, which was what he'd said when he raised rent on me 4 months earlier. When I questioned him, he got angry and switched tactics, now claiming that he didn't have enough space. This was a very interesting thing for him to say, given that Tommy's corner had steadily expanded to include every square inch of the apartment, save for my bedroom. The kitchen sink was perpetually filled with dirty plates, and the ratio of spoiled to unspoiled food items in the fridge was usually 5-1. I made the mistake of complaining about this stuff, and all at once, Tommy was fuming. "I stop you right now," he said. "This mess, you created all by yourself. You need to get a job, young man. You're not 15 years old, you know. So if you don't like it, get your own place. You're a guest in this house." And so my search for a steady job and a new apartment began in earnest once again. I attended a job fair sponsored by Santa Monica College and got called in for a sales clerk gig at Armani Exchange in Beverly Hills, but didn't land it. I also interviewed for a bellman job at a fancy hotel called Shutters in Santa Monica. At the end of the interview, I was asked, "When can you start?" A few days later, I learned that a nephew of one of the managers had been judged the more promising bellman. The day I learned I lost out on the Shutters gig, I came home discouraged, only to be greeted by Tommy, who was once more pestering me about getting a job. I told him what had happened, hoping he'd extend some consolation. He didn't. "I don't care about your excuses," Tommy said, turning his back to me as he headed off into his curtain lair. "I don't want all your stress in my head." Infuriated, I had the most unpleasantly pleasurable fantasy of wrapping my hands around Tommy's neck and squeezing. To drive that thought away, I called to him through his layers of black velvet. What do you do for money anyway? I've known you for 2 years, and I've never seen you do anything but sit around. For a moment, silence. Then, I drive Mercedes, smart guy, so I must do something right. Having cooled myself down, I try to speak plainly and honestly. I'm working my ass off here. I go to school, I'm going on auditions, I'm trying to find a job, so I am working.
Okay, Tommy said warily. I got the picture.
Well, you've still never said what it is you do.
I told you, he said. I do the marketing stuff.
No, I said, I don't think so.
Well, your thinking is not my problem.
Marketing for who, Tommy?
That, he said, is none of your business at this time.
From behind the curtains, I soon heard the familiar Tommy puttering sounds that I'd grown to loathe. I headed for my corner of the apartment. That's fine, Tommy, I said. I'll pay the extra rent. You just keep lying to yourself. With that, I slammed the bedroom door. Tommy was shouting at me 5 seconds later.
Don't you slam your door, young man! Remember, you are a guest in this house!
I didn't say anything. 10 minutes later, though, he opened my door and began doing his nightly pull-ups. As soon as I get a place, I thought, watching his grave, spectral face go from white to an engorged red, I'm not even giving you a warning. I'm just going to disappear. A few days later, the Armani Exchange on Sunset Boulevard, where I'd fruitlessly dropped off an application months before, called me in for an interview, which ended with them hiring me on the spot. It only paid $8 an hour, but it was something. I returned home to tell Tommy the good news. Unusually, he wasn't there. When he finally returned around 6:30, I casually asked him where he'd been. Tommy played coy for a little while, but finally admitted he was taking a cold reading acting class run by Brian Reese, a fairly well-known acting teacher whose studio was right down the street. Reese's cold reading classes, wherein students gather outside on the corner of Hayworth and Fountain and have a couple of minutes to do unprepared readings of material they're not familiar with, were popular. I drive down Fountain sometimes and see actors of all ages out there cold reading for one another. I was happy to hear that Tommy was taking a class. As far as I knew, he'd had almost no human contact with anyone but me since he'd arrived in Los Angeles 8 months ago. I also figured a cold reading venue was more suited to Tommy's talents. In San Francisco, acting classes could be staid and self-important, at least in my experience. I imagined that Los Angeles's aspiring actors would be more receptive to Tommy's brand of thespian bonkers. Tommy assured me he was having a great time in the cold reading class.
I make some friends, he said. I can make friends too, you know. You think because you have blonde hair, you own the world?
He went on to tell me how his classmates would sometimes start chanting, Tommy, Tommy, as he got up on stage. L.A. was embracing Tommy Wiseau then. This was good for all sorts of reasons. Then, another positive development. A guy in my Santa Monica College film class mentioned that his friend was moving to Barcelona for work and needed a long-term subletter. As it happened, the apartment in question was across the street from Tommy's place. Better yet, all the subletter had to do was pay utilities and forward the guy's mail to him in Spain. And the place itself was gorgeous. A two-bedroom in a colonial-style building with an amazing view of sunset and lovely gardens in its shared courtyard area. Now all I had to do was break it to Tommy. He wasn't around when I got home. He was still at his cold reading class. While I was eating dinner, I noticed that Tommy had, for some reason, left his ID out on the kitchen table, along with a bunch of papers. It was a California state driver's license. Name, Thomas P. Wiseau. Date of birth, October 3rd, 1968. That would have made him 32 years old. I put the license down. Maybe all this time, Tommy hadn't been lying to me about his age. Was it possible he really was in his 30s? If Tommy wasn't lying about this, maybe he wasn't lying about everything else. His meetings, his origins, his work, either. Maybe I'd been in the wrong this whole time. A little while later, I went for a drive on Fountain and noticed a large group of gesticulating Brian Reese actors standing on the corner, talking and laughing and hanging out. Then I saw Tommy. He was standing 15 feet away from everyone, arms crossed, head down, leaning against a brick wall. He looked about as glum and lonely as a human being could look. I slowed and pulled my Lumina over to the curb. When Tommy glanced up and saw me, he smiled like a kid waiting to be picked up after his first day of school, a heartbreakingly genuine smile. I told him I had a few things to talk to him about later that night. Tommy didn't seem himself when he came back from class. Or rather, he didn't seem any of his many selves, not his manic self, not his petulant self, and not his zany self. He appeared instead profoundly defeated. This was surprisingly hard to see. I'd never known anyone as invincibly optimistic as Tommy, and I didn't realize how central that optimism was to my understanding of him until it was gone. As hard as our rooming together had been, I didn't feel very good about telling him I was moving out when he was in such a state. Tommy sat down at his glass-topped desk, leaving the curtains open behind him, always a sign he wanted to talk. "Maybe," he said after a while, "acting is not my destiny." "Did something happen in class?" I asked.
"Forget class for now. Hollywood won't do shit for me. All these months and no call, no audition, they don't want me. They don't want me to be the next Johnny Depp."
"Tommy," I said, "I know you don't believe that. Come on. You have your script now, you're writing a lot. Just keep doing that, keep pushing, and something will eventually happen." It was hard to give that advice because I didn't believe it myself. But then again, I realized, how was my disbelief in Tommy any different from my mother's disbelief in me? Who was I to know what was best for Tommy?
"Yeah," he said, unconvinced. "Talk is talk. Worry's resolved. I don't need the talk. I need something different."
"Okay, so what do you need?" He was silent for a moment, thinking about it. He turned to me, still slumped over in his chair.
"To be star," he said, "I need to reshape myself. Everything. My acting. I need to fix entire thing."
This sounded ominous. What does that mean? He knew he'd said too much.
"Look at you," he said, waving his hand at me. "You go on all these auditions. You do a good job and you get nothing. What does that mean for me? They will not give me chance."
I didn't know what it meant for him. I also didn't know what it meant for me. Tommy's loss of faith was so difficult to watch that it took a little of my faith right down the drain with it. "It's not supposed to be easy, Tommy. You've said so yourself."
"Easy nothing," he said. "No one want me. Bottom line."
No, the "I'm moving out" conversation would definitely not be happening tonight. I knew all the years of acting classes and relocating back and forth from San Francisco to LA had taken its toll on Tommy. I knew this was at least the third serious effort he'd made to be an actor. I knew that he had hoped it was going to be different this time. Of course he'd lost his stomach for acting. By this point, who wouldn't? Most of the people who start down this path wind up at a dead end. The odds of success are so dauntingly low that you have to be a special kind of crazy even to want to court such a fate. Optimism can sustain a young actor, but only for so long.
So, look, Tommy said, I have certain issue. I have to leave for a couple weeks.
Okay, I said. Are you going back to San Francisco?
He shook his head. No. I have work in the London, marketing stuff. People need me there. So I go for a while.
London? Tommy claimed to despise Europe. He'd often told me that he'd never go back, not under any circumstances.
Tommy saw the concern in my eyes. Don't worry about me, okay? And you still have apartment. I keep renting it for now.
I looked at Tommy carefully, trying to suss out the truth behind his statement. But there was so much anguish in his face, he had the eyes of a trapped, dying animal, that I had to look away.
So take care of yourself, Tommy said. Be good.
How long are you going to be gone?
Several weeks or so.
He stood and reached out to close his curtain.
Okay, so I'm tired now. I go to bed. We talk tomorrow, maybe.
It wasn't even midnight. This was normally when Tommy started to wake up.
Yeah, I said agreeably. Of course.
Tommy's hand was still on the curtain. It looked like he wanted to say something more, but he didn't. When I turned away, he pulled the curtain shut. I had a strong sense that Tommy wouldn't be there when I woke up. He wasn't, and he hadn't left a note. He was simply gone. I was packing up my things to move into my new place across the street when I noticed Tommy had left something out on his desk, I think, for me to find. It was a bulletin board. On it, Tommy had pinned a bunch of his headshots. In the middle of this Tommy collage was a picture of me. Knowing him, this didn't strike me as upsetting or creepy. Maybe it should have, but it didn't. I knew he was trying to figure out what it was that separated me from him. Why had I, in his mind, been accepted by Hollywood, and he had not? As though a picture could tell you that. All at once, I felt both immensely sad and immensely relieved he was gone. Somehow I knew I wouldn't see him again for a very long time. To my surprise, I liked working at Armani Exchange. It offered me a sense of normalcy and routine. Before I knew it, I was seeing a completely different side of being young in Los Angeles. One day I was being set up with a rich Lebanese customer's daughter, the next, having a friendly dinner with Joni Mitchell, to whom I had sold a sweater and her pal. Joni Mitchell was greatly amused to learn, halfway through our dinner, that I had no idea who Joni Mitchell was. She just seemed like a cool, artsy woman to me. It was as though not having Tommy around freed up all this trapped mental and emotional energy. I was friendlier, happier, and far more open than I'd ever been. You might say that, for the first time in my life, I was acting my age. And I was so thankful to finally have a job, which in turn made me pretty good at selling clothes. Within a couple of months, in fact, I was personally outselling the entire store staff. A general manager from Armani in New York came to visit and took me out to lunch. What are your career plans? He asked me. At that point in my life, career plans wasn't a phrase that often passed through my mind. While I wasn't expecting to see Tommy again for a while, I was certainly expecting to hear from him. But I didn't. No messages or calls. Weeks passed. It got to the point where I almost forgot Tommy existed. Like the last 2 years had been a strange, sometimes upsetting dream. From time to time, I'd go back to the old apartment to do laundry or check phone messages. And in the apartment's silence, Tommy would weigh heavily on my mind. Eventually, I decided to call him. Tommy always used to tell me, "We're on different highways. You are young, so we see things different. You go your way, I go my way." I never really understood what he meant by that, but I found myself thinking of those words while his phone was ringing. He didn't answer, so I left a message. "Hey, Tommy, just wondering how you're doing and how London is. I hope you're on a good highway." 6 weeks later, when I was at work, my manager called me over to the counter phone. This was odd. No one had ever called me at work. I heard him say, "I'm sorry, sir. I didn't understand that." "Tommy." I got on the phone.
I miss you, Tommy said, his voice shaky. "I miss you very much."
"Tommy," I said, "are you all right? Where are you?"
"I just wanted to say hello. I know you called me. I appreciate."
Tommy sounded even worse than he had that last night in his apartment. His words seemed more howled than spoken. At least a dozen people stood around me, customers, colleagues, my manager, so I comported myself as neutrally as possible. But my intuition was causing my blood to run as fast and icy as some Arctic floe. "I can't really talk," I said quietly. "Are you around later?"
"No," he said quickly. "Never mind. I just want to call and say I hope you're okay. Not to bother you. I just want to make sure."
"Make sure of what?"
"Just to make sure." "Okay, I have to go now.
Look, I'll try you later, all right?" And he just hung up. I stood there with the dial tone blaring in my ear, a non-transatlantic dial tone. Wherever Tommy was, it wasn't London. Tommy's call left me rattled. I went to his vacant apartment after work to see if he'd left a message there, since he didn't yet know I'd moved out. I stepped off the elevator on the third floor of the Crescent Heights building and started walking toward the apartment. I looked down into the aquamarine pool and thought about the first time I'd been there, how alive I'd felt. I realized that I missed the Tommy from that time. Not who he was now, and definitely not the life-draining roommate he'd become, but the free-spirited person he'd once been, who could cheer me up without even trying. When I tried to imagine Tommy now, I kept seeing him underwater, beyond reach, drowning. Inside, the answering machine light was blinking. I hit play, and suddenly Tommy's voice began filling up that apartment like a ghost.
"I'm in a bad place," he said. "I'm scared."
It sounded like he'd been crying.
"In your message, you talk about the highway? Well, I'm on highway. Highway of hell. Highway of dying. Highway of survival. It really is hell right now. I don't know what to do. Hopefully I can get out from this hell. I think maybe I go like James Dean, end in car. Or I disappear. Maybe I jump off Golden Gate Bridge."
He became quiet. Standing in the middle of that dark, vacant apartment, I crossed my arms. I felt a rush of cold air. Then Tommy said,
"I don't want to feel the pain. I don't believe in hell. I believe in God. Maybe God help me."
He hung up. I was shaking. I knew what I'd just heard. A suicide message. I called him immediately, but he didn't answer. So I desperately urged him to call me back. I told him that I knew something terrible was happening, but unless he told me what it was, I couldn't help him. Whatever Tommy was running from, it had finally caught him. It was holding him down and breathing in his face. I waited in the apartment, hoping the phone would ring. A few minutes later, it did.
"Hey, stranger," he said.
He sounded a little more stable. Not much more, but a little.
"I cannot talk for long. I get your message. I appreciate."
"Tommy," I said, "what is going on?"
"I cannot tell you. I have a problem, but I can't talk about it. If something happens, I let you know. Look, it's late here in London. I need to sleep. I did some quick math and determined that in London, it was actually 11 a.m. You're an important person to me, he said. I just want to tell you that. And he hung up. I wanted to help, but I didn't even know where to go or to whom I should turn. I suspected that Tommy was in San Francisco, if anywhere. I knew he was too proud to admit that he was not in London, and maybe he had good reason. After hearing his voice, I sensed that he wanted, even needed, space. What was so haunting was that I'd known Tommy for 2.5 years, and there was literally no one else in his life for me to call or turn to. As far as I knew, I was all he had. After I'd been at Armani Exchange a few months, I learned that Barney's New York had sent secret shoppers all over Los Angeles to find the best salespeople in town. When the secret shoppers report came back, Barney's offered me full benefits and $47,000 plus commission to sell women's clothes in their flagship Beverly Hills store. As a 22-year-old unemployed actor, I thought about the offer for maybe a nanosecond before accepting. Barney's turned out to be a viper pit filled with a celebrity clientele, insanely competitive salespeople, and an air of acquisitive materialism as thick as LA smog. I was doing roughly as well with sales as I had at Armani, but felt profoundly out of place. The most significant thing that happened during my time at Barney's was meeting a young woman who worked downstairs in the makeup department. Her name was Amber, and we started dating almost immediately. I knew Tommy was still alive because when I'd visited my family over Christmas, I'd reached him on his San Francisco condo's landline. I heard this loud clatter like he dropped the phone before getting a solid hold on it. When Tommy finally, breathlessly said, "Hello?" I told him I was in San Francisco and that it would be great to see him. "I'm sorry," Tommy said. "I cannot see you. I'm not around." Of course, he hung up. By the spring, I was living on my own, working a full-time job, dating Amber, and not doing much acting or auditioning at all. For a while, Aaron Spelling's production company had me on option for a television pilot, but it didn't come to anything, which was fine. I had a normal, comfortable life, and my acting dream had sort of faded away, just as Tommy had. Amber knew nothing of Tommy, aside from a few complimentary stories I'd shared of him, and those memories felt increasingly distant from the person I was now. Eventually, I left Barney's to take a less remunerative but far happier part-time job at French Connection. Months had passed since I'd last seen Tommy. Iris Burton had told me she was retiring, and I was thus heading into the professional unknown. This was when Tommy finally got back in touch with me, 9 months after he disappeared. Tommy left a message on my cell. He sounded as though he'd stabilized and announced he was moving back to Los Angeles, but into a larger apartment on the same floor of his Crescent Heights complex. "You know my style," Tommy said. I did. Black velvet curtains, t-shirt pillowcases, and dirty dishes. A few days later, Amber and I went on a little vacation to Mexico. As soon as we crossed over the border back into San Diego, Tommy called my cell from his new Hollywood apartment. He sounded upbeat and said he was looking forward to seeing me. I knew it was going to be strange to see him again. Since he had disappeared, I'd done almost nothing to further my acting dreams. It was almost like Tommy's presence had forced me to stay focused on acting. Amber had allowed me to hide from my dream. She didn't push me, and she didn't ask questions about it. She accepted me for who I was when she met me, which was fine. It was pleasant, comfortable even. But it wasn't who I really wanted to be. That said, I wasn't sure I was ready to, or even could,
welcome Tommy back into my life. As much as I'd worried about him and occasionally missed having him around, I knew too well the stress and frustration he was capable of sowing. When Amber pressed, I told her that my friend Tommy was back in town. But before I could explain more, she said, "Great, I'd love to meet him." On May 7th, 2001, I walked from my apartment over to the Crescent Heights building, not at all sure what I was going to find. Tommy had been in a dark, dangerous place, I knew, and part of me was prepared for anything. If I'm being truthful, though, what I found was almost exactly what I'd expected. Tommy was waiting outside for me in the building driveway, wearing baggy blue sweatpants and sunglasses. I couldn't see his shirt because he'd wrapped himself in an enormous and ratty black shawl. His hair was much longer and blacker and wavier. As he walked toward me in his Roman sandals with white socks, I noticed how small and deliberate his steps were. Tommy seemed like someone you'd see standing alongside the road in the middle of nowhere. He seemed lost, ghostly. He also looked different physically. His face was fuller, and his body seemed more muscular. He'd obviously been working out. His stomach, though, was slightly bloated, with a paunch that peeked out from the fold in his peasant shawl. When I got closer to Tommy, all I could think was how much heavier he looked. Not only physically heavier, but emotionally and even spiritually heavier.
"Bonjour, monsieur," Tommy said, smiling.
"Bonjour," I said, hugging him.
"Look at you," Tommy said. "You look great. No stomach."
"Glad to be back?" I asked him. Tommy sighed and looked around. It wasn't that nice a day. Smoggy, a little too hot, a little too glary.
"Los Angeles is Los Angeles," he said. "And San Francisco is San Francisco. I miss San Francisco a little bit."
"So you stop by San Francisco between here and London?" Tommy smiled.
"Let's go eat."
We wound up at Canner's Deli on Fairfax. Tommy still hadn't taken off his sunglasses. He didn't that whole day. Indeed, I wouldn't see Tommy without his sunglasses for weeks.
"So," Tommy said, placing his hands flat on the table, "do I look different?"
I remember what he'd said to me that last night in the apartment.
"To be star, I need to reshape everything."
"You look a little different," I said.
"I make many changes to my life and myself. Now it's time to begin the real work."
This could only mean one thing.
"Did you finish your script?" "I have finished my script, for your information. It is completed and it is copyright. The title is The Room."
"Totally finished?"
"Yes, 100%. No one has read it yet. Today you will be the first."
I wasn't able to aimlessly spend time with Tommy as I once had. With Amber in my life, my hang-around mandate was far more limited. Amber was waiting for me right now, back at my apartment.
"You want me to read it today? Like, right now?" "Yes," he said. "We read today. It's very necessary."
"How many pages is it?"
"You'll see for yourself."
"Well, Tommy," I said delicately, "the thing is I don't really have all day. My girlfriend's waiting for me."
Tommy stared at me through those sunglasses. "You tell your girl you are busy this afternoon. She can wait."
Right after our food came, Amber called me on my cell. I didn't pick up. 10 minutes later, she called me again, and again after that. Tommy finally put his fork down and laughed.
"Girlfriend is serious, huh?"
I could feel it happening at that moment. I was slipping back into the orbit of Tommy's planet.
So tell me about the acting now, Tommy said. What's happening? My mouth opened, but I said nothing. I had nothing to say. I was looking at myself literally and figuratively in Tommy's sunglasses. I didn't want to admit that I'd barely thought about acting at all in the last few months. It had just gone away. I almost felt like I owed Tommy for getting me here, and was disappointed in myself for setting my dream aside. Let's eat fast, I said. I want to read this script of yours. That's the idea, Tommy said. His new, bigger apartment looked very similar to the old one, minus the black drapes and food cake dishes in the sink. Don't worry, a week later, they were back. Tommy sat me down in a chair and said, "You must prepare yourself physically and emotionally for what you are about to read. You will see many reflections of your life in my script. Are you ready?" "I think so," I said, not knowing whether to be amused or terrified. Tommy went into his second bedroom for what felt like a long time. When he finally came out, he was cradling a Kinko's laminated script, 74 pages long, the title page of which bore the words, "The Room," in 144-point font size, with three separate copyright notices below it. "Remember," Tommy said, "it is copyrighted." I turned the first slick, laminated page and found a director's note preamble that began, "This play can be played without any age restrictions. It will work if the chemistry between all the characters makes sense." I looked up at him. "So you settled on making it a play?" "Yes," he said. "It's easier that way for now. And maybe, if you behave yourself, you can direct it for the theater." I laughed in spite of myself. Maybe I should read it first. Tommy sat down in a chair directly across from me, and that's how I began reading. With the script silent, watchful, copyright-minded author wearing sunglasses and wrapped in a black shawl sitting 5 feet away. Even though Tommy wanted The Room to be a play, his script opened with an external shot of an apartment building south of Market. From there, it pushed into a room that was described as being furnished simply. An alarm clock rings, and a man reaches to the clock and turns it off. He sleepily arouses and puts on his shorts and walks slowly to the bathroom. When the man emerges, he smiles tenderly at the woman with whom he shares his bed. The first line spoken by this woman, "I am not a slave here, am I?" The man responds, "Did you like last night?" The man is named Johnny, the woman Lisa. They proceed to have a fight about the man's imminent promotion, which Lisa accuses Johnny of being overly focused on. Of his promotion, Johnny says, "Old man Donkey lets me know today." Lisa was a terror, shrill, controlling, greedy, selfish, and vain. She had to be one of the most chauvinistically written characters I'd ever encountered in a script. Until, that is, I met her mother, Claudette. "What do you think?" Tommy asked suddenly. "Do you see the reflections? Don't be scared, this is life. Do you see yourself yet?" "Let me finish," I said. By this point, I was searching Tommy's script for clues as to what had gone on over the last 9 months. There was a lot of dialogue about property and money and the computer business, very little of which I could attach to anything. There was nothing about being sick or dying or desperation, at least nothing beyond the desperation Johnny feels about his relationship with Lisa. Everything in the script seemed so curiously devoid of real emotion. Instead, I read one conversation after another that opened with lines like, "Hi, Mom, how are you doing? Oh, hi, I'm very busy, how you doing?" And, "Hello, Peter, this is Lisa, how are you?" I did spot quite a few small details from Tommy's and my stint as roommates,
A lot of the dialogue he attributed to Mark, for instance, who sleeps with Lisa and ruins Johnny's life, was Tommy-altered versions of things that I'd said, which was another considerable problem. Everyone in the script sounded like Tommy. You have too much competition in the computer field. You are not drinking your cognac, dear. It will taste good with pizza. I heard that, Lisa. Get your pretty little buns in here and help. This last line is almost certainly something Johnny or Mark says to Lisa, right? Wrong. This is something Lisa's mother says to Lisa. It was all 100% Tommy. Soon enough, I began connecting the dots. The constant talk about money, about best friends. Johnny and Mark are best friends, but Mark also tells Peter he's his best friend. Michelle and Lisa are best friends. Johnny's other best friends all show up for his party. The whole script was like an advisory warning about the perils of having friends at all. About trust, about fear, about truth. Tommy's life study of human interaction had been put into a final draft blender and sprinkled with the darkness of whatever he'd been living through over the last 9 months. The one thing Tommy's script wasn't about, despite its characters' claims, love. I had a sobering, sad, and powerful realization. Our friendship was the most human experience Tommy had had in the last few years. Maybe ever. The happy news was that whatever Tommy had been running from, he'd managed to turn and face it down into script. Instead of killing himself, he wrote himself out of danger. He did this by making his character the one spotless human being amid chaos, lies, and infidelity. Johnny was perfect. He was a lost innocent, a pure victim. And Johnny's story was the perfect American drama. In Tommy's mind, anyway. When I came to the last page, Tommy asked me, "So what do you think?" What else could I say? "It was excellent, Tommy. You should be proud you finished it." Tommy smiled. "Wow, I can't believe you give me compliment. Do you have any suggestions? Because I think about them." "No," I said, "I think it's perfect." Now that the perfection of his script was settled, Tommy sighed in relief. "It's so much work to write," he said. "I worked so hard on this to bring it to the life. And I tell you right now, when people see this play, they will be shocked." "Yes," I said. "They would be shocked, yes." "Can you imagine this?" Tommy said. "On the stage, in front of so many people?" I tried to imagine that. I saw the people patiently waiting for the play to begin, their playbills in hand. The theater would be a 20-seater in some corner of Hollywood. There'd be a leak in the roof. It would be raining. The actors would be Tommy and, oh Jesus, probably me, doing it out of pity, and the audience would be made up entirely of my good sport family and friends, and maybe some homeless people who'd been lured in with plastic cups of wine. And the play would begin. Based on what I just read, it would either horrify everyone or bring everyone to their knees with laughter. Maybe both. "I think," I said, slowly and diplomatically, "that your play, if staged really well, would be something incredible." "Really?" Tommy asked, leaning forward. "Really," I said. "I think so too," Tommy said, looking away. "I think it would be so powerful." 15. God forgive me. Betty Schaefer. "I just think that pictures should say a little something." Joe Gillis. "Oh, one of the message kids. Just a story won't do." Sunset Boulevard. Tommy kneeled down in front of the condo set fireplace, made a ponderous sign of the cross, and raised a large silver prop gun to his mouth. He was rehearsing his character's final moment on camera, his most dearly anticipated acting feat, Johnny's suicide. Here's how the room begins to end. Johnny becomes infuriated by Lisa's behavior at a surprise birthday party, trashes his and Lisa's condo in a rage, somehow gets his hands on a gun, requests divine forgiveness, and shoots himself in the head. The night Tommy conceived The Room, he promised a riveting cinematic experience that would leave people so shaken they wouldn't be able to sleep for 2 weeks. Now, several years later, Tommy was in that promised moment, and half the cast and crew were trying, with spotty success, not to laugh. Take after take, Tommy was so focused on capturing Johnny's emotional upheaval that he was floundering out of frame, wincing, crying out, flailing his arms, all this after he'd pulled the trigger. Meanwhile, Byron was doing his best to get Tommy to please, for the love of God, stay in frame. Byron's on-set evolution had been interesting. Neither a script supervisor nor a first assistant director, he'd gone from being a stagehand to a surrogate Sandy, coaching Tommy step by step, moment to moment. I was beginning to think of him as the room's director of yelling at Tommy. When Tommy's kneeling degenerated into a lazy slouch, Byron would yell, "Be erect!" Tommy would arch his back obediently. 5 seconds later, he'd be slouched over again and out of frame. "This is you, buddy!" Byron kept coaching. "Come on, this is it! Energy, Tommy!" Tommy, though, looked flustered, lost, confused. Tommy couldn't synchronize his suicide moment with a loud, helpful bang being called out by Byron. Sometimes he'd still be kneeling there after the bang, as though nothing had happened. Amy, the makeup artist, who was standing just off camera, would try to time Tommy's trigger pull with a fake blood squib, which squirted the fireplace behind Tommy with a burst of barely noticeable spatter. This not-so-special effect looked like someone sitting off camera had whacked a ketchup packet with a hammer. Tommy's delivery of his final line, "God forgive me," also fluctuated from take to take. In a couple of takes, he whispered it. In a couple, he said it with no emotion at all. In a couple, came out like this. Why, God, oh my God, forgive me. Bang, blood splatter. Tommy was still kneeling there. Then, all at once, he collapsed. Byron was behind the camera, glowering under his backward baseball cap, looking more and more like an embattled Little League coach. "Come on," Byron said to Tommy, as he showed him how to hold the gun properly. "You can do this." By this point, most everyone else had given up maintaining any facade of professionalism. You could see giggling crew members wander into shots. There was no director of photography listed on the slate, and no one was keeping track of take numbers, neither of which mattered, as the slate was rarely clear. Scene after scene began with the camera out of focus, simply because no one cared enough to check. This new level of on-set laissez-faireism went unnoticed by Tommy. He was too preoccupied with his own troubles, such as figuring out how to smoothly retrieve his silver prop gun from its box. Why Johnny even has a loaded handgun in his condo is a subject of fevered room fan debate. When the time came to fill the suicide sequence, Tommy decided to stash the prop handgun in a small brown treasure box, which he then placed at the base of Johnny and Lisa's fireplace, because loaded firearms should always be kept near open flames. For what it's worth, Tommy's original room script contained an even more bizarrely elaborate gun-finding scenario. Johnny goes into the closet and throws out everything he sees, and finds a wooden box about the size of a shoebox. He tries to pull it open, but he can't. He throws it to the floor, but it doesn't open. He kicks it,